Hi everyone, I'm Gary Noll. Always nice to share this empowering hour with you. Today, from the University of Dhaka, which is in Bangladesh, the role of ashwagandha, a compound in the management of Alzheimer's disease. Very important study, and that will help the millions upon millions of Americans and people worldwide, because we're heard worldwide, in helping with this scourge. Also today, from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, calcium, when you have enough, precisely directs your blood flow into the brain. What's that about? I'll explain. Then we'll take a look at how 1 in 20 cases of dementia occurs in younger people. Yeah, people under 65. Mayo Clinic says that. How's that happening? What can we do? What can we do at any age to prevent dementia? Remember, it starts early. What about Washington University School of Medicine study about the good cholesterol can protect your liver? I'll explain the difference between good cholesterol and bad cholesterol and why that's important so that we can have a healthy cholesterol all the time. And then from Loyola University in Chicago, vitamin D supplementation may be a low-cost supportive care therapy for women with metastatic breast cancer. Wow. And I just counseled someone 5 o'clock this morning on what to do about metastatic breast cancer after an advanced stage near death, and that there are options. And how about the University of Illinois with lutein can counter cognitive aging? Everyone should be aware of that and benefit from that. I'll explain that in the details because it's all in the details. And how about from Colorado State University, where aerobic exercise boosts healthy brain aging? It's all about aging now, if you're paying attention. But unfortunately, the mainstream media would like us to believe that, well, aging is a disease. And the more you age chronologically, the more disease you're susceptible to. And that's not true at all. And I will challenge those who believe that, well, it's kind of inevitable. You're a certain age, you have to act your age. That's not true either. Almost everything we've heard about the aging process is wrong. Not intentionally, just they haven't looked where the answers are. They keep looking at the same paradigm and wondering why there's not a better outcome. So we're going to look at a different paradigm. And I'm finishing up a major book on aging right now and a very important article on aging. I'm submitting the article for peer review publication, and then I'll present it on the air, and then I'll post it. And this is something that can help everyone in this audience. Brand new information. And that's why I'm hopeful that it will get some people kickstarting their healthier habits. Also today, a commentary from someone that we have a great deal of respect for. That's Chris Hedges from SharePost, a collective suicide machine. That's his. But also today, and I'll be adding my own commentary on that, plus a brand new, in-depth investigative report on GMOs, and a response to the New York Times heavy promotion on their cover, their Sunday magazine section, on pro-GMOs. Well, we're going to deconstruct their arguments, and we're going to show you that their idea of learning to love GMOs, that's the title of their article, ours is learning to loathe GMOs, a critical response to the New York Times. We will be sending this today to the New York Times editorial board, all of their editorial board, and challenging them on a lack of objectivity, and also to the author, professor, highly regarded and highly respected professor, and I will give her the complete benefit of a doubt. As a result, there'll be no attacking her, but rather deconstructing her arguments, and then hopefully that will open it up to a larger debate. And I've invited her to come on this program, as I have D'Angelo to come on this program to debate me on her thesis. And we're hopeful that someone on that level will take us up so the audience can hear multiple sides and decide if any of it makes sense to them. Also today, I'm going to play what I consider an extraordinarily important clip from a person who knows what he's talking about. He is Professor Sukarat Bhakadi, B-H-A-K-D-I, He's a medical doctor with over 50 years in science and medicine, professor, very prestigious institution, and he has a background in immunology, pathology, and so he's going to tell us, and you can accept or reject it, that we already have antibody memory of COVID-19, rendering 99% of us immune. And this is not only makes vaccination unnecessary, in his opinion, but revaccination potentially threatens our life. And we're seeing more and more studies on that coming out. But why aren't we hearing about this anywhere else in the news? Why is it just vaccinate, mandate the vaccines? If you don't vaccinate, you're a danger to society. You're irresponsible. You're stupid. When we're finding just the opposite is true, and in fact, MIT has shown that those who are not vaccinating because they're anti-vaccine. To the contrary, they're pro-vaccine, but they're looking at the side effects of the first type of genetically engineered vaccine, this RNA vaccine of its kind, and they don't want to jump in there and then end up with side effects. Because when you have tens of thousands of dead people around the world from the vaccine and millions upon millions injured, many permanently from the vaccine, and now we're finding out that people who are vaccinated are shedding the vaccine, and we're finding out that people who have been vaccinated are coming down at a higher percentage with COVID again, and that the antibody protection only lasts about 2 to 3 months, that means they're lining us up to have everyone have multiple vaccines. It's a whole industry with hundreds of companies involved, and no one is saying, hold on a second, shouldn't we at least be cautious, engage the precautionary principle of let us make sure that this is safe before we inoculate a whole world? And why aren't you talking about lifestyle changes to prevent this? Why aren't we talking about building up people's immune system? Why aren't we not talking about the most vulnerable people, those with comorbidities, of working with them to help them overcome their comorbidities? None of that. Why aren't we talking about repurposing old FDA-approved drugs that are shown to be non-toxic and very effective, far more so than any vaccine? But we're not. So that should tell you that there's another agenda afoot. And Dr. Bacardi is going to give you a demonstration. I suggest you go to prn.fm, scroll down to where it says Gary's notes, and you can watch him because he has a blackboard. It's a little technical. I'm not going to play the whole clip, but I'll explain what he is saying. And also, for those of you who sent me, and a lot of people sent it to me, a highly regarded medical doctor in Italy was supposed to do an ad for pro-vaccine, and boy, did she let it rip. Because most people in this audience don't speak Italian, I'll read what she has to say, just part of her, for about a minute, because she goes after the vaccine. I mean, no holes barred. So that didn't work out so well over there. But now we have probably 100,000 more or less physicians and scientists who are challenging Anthony Fauci, the World Health Organization, and yet none of them are given any credibility. Even the Nobel Prize winners, even the people who've had impeccable credentials, orthodox against orthodox. But these are people in the front trenches actually treating people. They're the ones I trust, not the bureaucrats in Washington or the World Health Organization or Anthony Fauci. So all this we're going to share today. Just a quick reminder and just a little bit of an explanation. I've been on this sister station, WBI, for 45 years. And there have been periods of time in that 45 years that I've seen some very important positive changes. And then there was the effort to sequester a political identity for the station and remove all of the progressive minds. And they did, and they succeeded. Not just here, but across the whole network. And boy, could this foundation learn some lessons from how really successful nonprofit radio stations and nonprofit foundations work. And it's not about different groups fighting each other nonstop, which is always the case with Pacifica, and no one having any qualifications in nonprofit radio or nonprofit foundations or fundraising, but thinking they know everything. There's nothing more unique than people who are so self-righteous and so arrogant, so conceited, that their ideology is all that's important. And that's permanent throughout the whole system. As a result, today, we are a zombie network, last in every market. I wish it weren't so. The only people who are not getting the attention they deserve, unfortunately, are the audience. You see, when you call in and you make a pledge, you have every right to expect that in a timely way. Unfortunately, that's not happening, so I can't do any more pledging. And as part of the responsibility of not doing any more pledging, I can't stay in a station that says if you don't pledge, you can't stay. And that's fine. I respect that. I would love to see all of our older hosts, myself included, gracefully move away to allow young, vital voices that represent all the boroughs and the neighborhoods where it's really community radio. I think that's what would really save and hopefully re-energize the station. It shouldn't be used to attack other people. Nobody wants to hear that. And those who do want to hear that, well, that's part of the problem of the station. People want to be empowered in a positive way, not listen to denigration and personal and ad hominem attacks. That doesn't work. If you want to see why it doesn't work, just look at all the stations. Every station in Pacifica is just, unfortunately, their own life support. And it is not going to get better until they completely change how they're managing. I won't go into how I believe that they could remanage, repurpose, and then resuscitate, which the stations deserve, the audience deserves. But you can't have it both ways. I also am fully empathetic with the management who simply says, we have too few listeners to the station. Our bills are not capable of being met with the pledges that currently come in. That's a crisis. What you do, however, and unfortunately, you say, if whatever money comes in, what is most likely to cause a problem? Well, turning off the electricity, not paying salaries, not having people show up for work. And guess who gets left out of that? Frequently, that's the audience. And yet it should be just the opposite. Your audience should be number one priority. But if you don't have the money to pay every bill, some bills won't get paid. I'm very empathetic with the fact that the management finds itself in that position at this time. But we have to be more creative, we have to be more positive, and we have to look at every possible way that through programming and through maybe even making a station completely voluntary and community-based, that there will still be a heartbeat that will serve the local community. So if you turn on the radio soon and you don't hear me here, understand that I've appreciated the responsibility I've had on this air for a long time. But I will continue on Progressive Radio Network and all the other stations around the country and around the world that carry this. You can call this number and listen to my show live any day. Write it down, 717-734-6955. 717-734-6955. Now we go to the latest on health and healing, and that's something everyone benefits from. Well, what they're finding is ashwagandha. Let me spell it for you. A-S-H-W-A-G-A-N-D-H-A, ashwagandha. It's a very powerful herb, has a lot of healing benefits, but one that's not been noticed before but is now, is that it helps people with dementia or other neurodegenerative disorders, including cognitive decline and memory deficits, due mainly to a beta amyloid deposition in the brain, what is called the tau, T-A-U, protein hyperphosphorylation. And so this is important that you use ashwagandha if you have someone who has memory loss, brain damage. By the way, one of the best things you can do is light therapy and hyperbaric therapy. Hyperbaric is good for burns, of course, but stroke, absolutely, and brain damage, absolutely. Look at the scientific literature. Call the physicians who are actually using hyperbaric, and it will make a tremendous difference. And then, of course, there are supplements and different protocols you can use to rebuild much of your brain, and we've done it. And we have people, you've heard them on the air here, who have made major improvements. reverse conditions that their doctors, neurologists told them were irreversible. And yet my scientific studies, of which I've done 49, were all overseen by board-certified neurologists. So take your ashwagandha as just one part of an overall protocol. Also, a lot of green juices will help as well. Another study found that, well, we have to have a good amount of calcium in our body because unlike the rest of the body, there is not enough real estate in the brain for stored energy. Instead, the brain relies on hundreds of miles of blood vessels within it to supply fresh energy via the blood. Yet, how the brain expresses a need for more energy during increased activity and then directs its blood flow specifically to hot spots until now was poorly understood. Now, the good news is the University of Maryland School of Medicine and the University of Vermont have shown how the brain communicates to blood vessels when it needs for energy increase and how these blood vessels respond by relaxing or constricting to direct blood flow to specific brain regions. How cool is that? This was published in the current issue of Science Advances, and the researchers say that understanding how the brain directs energy to itself in intricate detail can help determine what goes wrong in conditions like Alzheimer's and dementia, where faulty blood flow is a predictor of cognitive impairment. If the blood does not get, the brain does not get blood to where it needs the blood, well, then the neurons become stressed, and over time they deteriorate, ultimately leading to cognitive decline and memory problems. Large arteries feed medium-sized vessels known as arterioles that then feed even tinier capillaries, so small that only a single blood cell can pass through at once. In fact, there was an article, I believe it was in 2017, Nature Neuroscience. The researchers showed that electrical pulses coursing through the capillaries direct blood flow from the medium-sized arterioles supply large enough and coursing through the capillaries directly into the blood. Into the brain. In any case, it's just using calcium, I would say about 800 milligrams a day, along with 800 milligrams of magnesium from citrate, would help tremendously in this process. By the way, there are 5,000 calcium signals per second in capillaries in the tiny section of the brain visible through the window, which they say amounts to about 1 million of these responses every second in the entire brain's blood vessel system. So for those of you who thought everything was just purely evolutionary, well, not true, but that's all right. We can allow the skeptics to hold their linear and Descartes view of the world, and the rest of us who believe in energy, have deep faith in higher principles, know that there's a different argument here. I don't have time for that argument. It's an argument I share with atheists and who I respect, and agnostics, and to let them know at a science level, I can explain a lot of things that science cannot show, but still exist. I'll just give you one example. Why is it that you were never taught, not a single lesson in life, how often to blink, your eyelids to come up and down? They're creating a tear duct, which that tear then moisturizes the eye and prevents it from chafing and going blind. Well, who taught it to do that? Who taught your stomach how much hydrochloric acid, how much pepsin and amylase and lipase enzymes that break down your food? And how long did it take to break it down? And why is it that some foods take longer than others? And then what happens if you drink a beverage, cold beverage or hot beverage with a meal? How does that impact the hydrochloric acid levels and the enzyme levels in your stomach? All this happens without you ever being taught. And yet it happens in every single person on earth, or they would die. Well, who taught it to do that? Who taught your heart when you're running to speed up the pulse and blood pressure, blood going through your veins, and the release of glycogen, the stored energy in your cells? Who taught it that? But when you stop, it comes back down to normal. It doesn't go below normal. And when you're sleeping, it goes down again. Your whole metabolism goes slower. by 10%. Who taught it that? And there are 100 other objective lessons to what life is about. Remember, life was never meant to be figured out. It was meant to be lived at a higher level of awareness and consciousness. And from the Mayo Clinic comes a study about dementia. 1 in 20 cases, dementia is now in people who are 65 and younger. And I've seen it in people as young as 50. Why? Simple. It's not complicated. Electromagnetic pulses from cell phones and computers that we have now everywhere, they're ubiquitous today. Smart meters on homes, 5G, and all those cell towers. That's putting pulsed electromagnetic pollution right into your brain and your body, and that speeds up inflammatory responses all over the body. That's one. Alcohol consumption's two. Poor diet, three. Lack of exercise, four. Excessively sedentary, five. Stress, six. Those are just six reasons why we're seeing dementia. When we live a life without ever asking what is the likely outcome if I make the wrong choice, but also begs the question, do I want to know the truth or do I stop at the certainty of my own beliefs? What if your certainty of beliefs are wrong? So those are just some of the things we need to know. So therefore, all the more reason to pay careful attention. And finally, from Washington University School of Medicine, we have what is called the good cholesterol, which is the HDL cholesterol, high-density lipoprotein, and it protects the liver. And the HDL protects the liver by blocking inflammatory signals produced by common gut bacteria. This is published in the peer-reviewed Neuroscience. So when you're eating good bacteria, meaning good probiotics, and you're not eating sugar, then you're telling your cholesterol that you're going to get feedback from the intestinal microbiome, enhancing your immune system and enhancing the protection of your liver. It works that way in an overly simplified fashion. That's the latest on Health and the Healing. We are 22 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to share a special commentary. Richard Gale and myself spent about almost all night, so we'll share this with you in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. This article will be posted on GaryNoll.com along with hundreds of other articles, as well as on PRN.fm. You can watch our upcoming video that we're going to share with you in a few moments, also by going to PRN.fm. Share this information with people. You have no idea what it means to connect with someone who you didn't know what they might do with something, but then they start to share it and suddenly more people become aware. We like to share real scholarship. The fact that we take the time to look at the science, look for the truth without any political, ideological agenda. Whatever the truth is, that's what we're sharing. This is called Learning to Loathe GMOs, a critical response to the New York Times. In its July 19th issue, the New York Times Magazine published, in our opinion, a brilliant piece of twisted pseudoscientific propaganda. The essay entitled Learning to Love GMOs is truly stunning. Its author, journalist Jennifer Kahn, takes the readers who would have, in most probability, little or no understanding of genetic engineering or genetically modified organisms, the GMOs, through what we believe is a fictional labyrinth of outdated and conflated GMO similitudes to an endpoint where readers might believe GMOs are really cool, completely safe, and absolutely necessary. We challenge that. Kahn spins the story of Kathy Martin's research to develop genetically engineered purple tomatoes high in the antioxidant anthocyanin as the work of a solo humanitarian to improve consumers' health by providing nutrient-rich GMO products. And indeed, that may be the single motive behind Kathy Martin's work. What is missing, however, from Kahn's equation is that the research was conducted at one of the world's oldest and most prestigious independent centers for plant science, the Johns Innes center in the United Kingdom. The center, which is registered as a charity, lists over 500 employees and is funded by some of the largest proponents of genetically modified plants. Who might that be? Well, let's start at the top. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council, what are called the JICs, website includes purple tomatoes as one of its projects that combines transcription factors, biosynthetic genes, and iRNA, interference RNA, with the availability of natural tomato mutants, end quote. The iRNA, or post-transcription gene slicing, is a method to silence certain genes that researchers desire to curtail their expression. The New York Times article makes an effort to advance the flawed agrochemical mantra of substantial equivalence without citing the term. Substantial equivalence is a metaphysical belief that natural foods, the kind most people eat every day, that are grown on farms from seeds that are not genetically engineered, and those can serve as a basis for determining the safety and nutritional profiles of foods engineered in a laboratory by genetic biotechnological methods. The early acceptance of GMOs was largely based upon the unproven hypothesis of substantial equivalence. So in lay language, let's just say you have two tomatoes. One tomato genetically engineered in a lab. The other one, well, just grown organically. The USDA and other agencies and advocates for genetic engineering would like us to believe they're both substantially the same. Ah, was this ever tested? Did they prove this? No. The Times article makes an effort to advance the flawed agrochemical mantra of substantial equivalence without citing the term. Substantial equivalence is a metaphysical belief that natural foods, organically grown foods, foods that come from just regular heirloom seeds planted in the ground that we've used throughout all of history, they're virtually substantially the same as genetically modified seeds that come from a laboratory. Well, does that make sense to you? Then the question is, what science did they provide to prove that? Well, they didn't. It was an interesting hypothesis. But that hypothesis was enough to gain early acceptance of GMOs based largely upon the unproven concept of substantial equivalence. The USDA's adoption of this concept during Bill Clinton's first term in the White House gave genetically modified seed companies a free pass to avoid submitting trial evidence to prove the environmental and health safety of genetically modified crops. Since the ruling claims that GMOs genetically function identically to their natural counterparts, no compliance of safety regulations should necessarily apply. Therefore, big ag firms did not have to worry about, well, those strict regulatory hurdles. We just passed them, which otherwise apply to all other products, such as all the pharmaceutical drugs, all processed foods, pesticides, cosmetics, and chemical additives, but not GMOs. However, during the past decade, a flurry of research has shown that the substantial equivalence hypothesis is patently false. Examples: Alexandria University in Egypt, the Permaculture Research Institute, and the Norwegian Center for Biosafety each found genetically modified crops to be fundamentally different. Yes, that's the actual science, not hypothesis. But we're not looking now at the details in many of these articles or what the GMO industry in general wants us to believe. No problem about safety, no problem about eating them. Even if they're genetically engineered, they're the same as if you ate a regular tomato, corn on the cob, etc. Well, but that's not the end of it. In addition, studies have confirmed that the amount of nutrients, or what is called the nutrient levels, in your traditional organically raised grown crops are substantially higher than the genetically modified varieties. new technological methods to create concise profiles of a food's molecular composition, notably what are called omics, O-M-I-C-S, were not available in the early 1900s when Clinton wore the mantle as America's first biotech president. Omic technology destroyed the big agricultural industry's arguments to support the lie about substantial equivalence. For example, King's College London published a study in Science Reports of Nature magazine revealing unquestionable genetic consequences between GMOs Roundup and non-GMO corn. The differences included changes in 117 proteins and 91 metabolites. Wow, that's a huge difference. And that's just one product, corn. What's the differences in apples or salmon, for that matter? Well, we don't know. But if you have 117 protein changes and 91 metabolite changes in just one item, then by no measure are they substantially equivalent. They're different. Despite substantial equivalence having been debunked, the erroneous hypothesis continues to linger in pro-GMO propaganda. However, in Kahn's recent essay, she attempts to shift attention away from the early generation of GMOs, which were engineered solely to sell more toxic pesticides, and emphasize GMO's potential for increasing nutritional health and to advance medicine. And indeed, she may have that as her actual intention. I'm not challenging her motive there. In order to add, we believe, a bit of balance, Kahn quotes James Madison University professor Alan Levinowitz, who accurately describes one fundamental criticism, among many others, against GMOs. Quote, "With genetic engineering, there's a feeling that we're mucking about with the essential building blocks of reality." He also says, quote, "We may feel okay about rearranging genes the way nature does, but we're not comfortable mixing them up between creatures," end quote, meaning you may have a change in cherries over time, but assuming that then you can mix all of those cherries into human genes without a consequence, well, that has not been researched. So we're assuming that everything that's genetically modified is healthy. No problems, no downside. But what about the precautionary principle? First, prove that whatever you're putting into our bodies, into the environment, is safe. Ah, well, that's a hurdle that wasn't crossed. But most disturbing for us is Kahn's failure to make any mention of the trail of environmental disasters and disease risks due to consuming genetically modified foods. In our opinion, she whitewashes the matter. She prefers we may forget the Monsanto soy corn, which now represents the majority of these foods grown in the United States, and those were developed solely to allow farmers to spray large amounts of highly toxic pesticides without injuring the food. What? Yes, these crops contain notable concentrations of the pesticide that then find their way right into your body. So, let me understand this. So, if you sprayed some pesticides on crops, the pesticide may kill the product. Yes. But if you modify the genes so that the food can absorb a lot of a toxic pesticide, then the food survives to be sold and consumed. All right. But are there tests taken after every time a farmer harvests thousands to hundreds of thousands of these corns to go to market? No. No, that's not done. Well, then how do we know how much of a pesticide from a food, any given food that's been genetically modified, to have pesticide resistance, how much that ends up in a person's body or in a baby food? Where are the tests showing that all of the foods genetically engineered have been proven by lab analysis not to contain high amounts of pesticides? Good luck finding that. So this all based upon assumptions. I thought this was supposed to be based upon science. Well, remember, who benefits then? Well, the farmer does. But then the pesticide maker, like Monsanto, benefits even most because they're going to be able to sell you a type of corn that, hey, you can put a lot of pesticide like Roundup on that and it's not going to kill the plant. Wow. Nor should we forget that Roundup-grown foods may be destroying people's microbiome. Last year, researchers at the University of Turku in Finland reported a, quote, conservative estimate that approximately 54% of organisms in our microbiome are, quote, potentially sensitive to glyphosate. That is the most commonly used herbicide, in the world. So despite her pro-GMO advocacy, Kahn could have taken the moral high road to at least apologize on Monsanto's behalf for the disasters glyphosate has left in its wake. Oh, and one other thing, not that it's that important, but right now the latest news on global warming is that for the first time in history, the great Amazon rainforest, the lungs of the planet, are actually giving off more carbon dioxide. That's not good. That contributes to global warming. Then as a carbon sink, where the gigantic forest brings in that carbon dioxide and sequesters it in the soil, protecting us. Why? Well, because huge swaths of the Amazon rainforest are being deforested every single day so that that ground can be used to plant, you guessed it, genetically engineered soybeans and other crops that are primarily fed either to people or to animals that are then fed to people without any concern of what it's doing to the planet and global warming or to our health. But that's the way it works at this moment. To date, Monsanto's glyphosate poisoning has been identified with the suppression of essential gut enzymes, amino acid synthesis, gluten intolerance, disruption of manganese pathways, neurological disease, cancer, autoimmune disease, to mention just some. And after being found not a problem for decades, all that changed when three single lawsuits were lost by Monsanto. They had to give the victims $2.4 billion in fines. But then there have been repeated losses since then, and now they're ordered to pay $10.5 billion in settlements. Yes, there are tens of thousands of lawsuits right now. So, why is that not being discussed? Well, her New York Times article would have better served the improvement of public health, in our opinion, as a warning rather than an applause to appease companies such as Bayer, Monsanto, Syngenta. And shame on the New York Times editors for permitting what we believe to be such biased misinformation to find its way into print. Kahn is eager to cite findings showing GMO benefits without indicating her sources. I mean, she may have them, but where are they? She tells us that environmental groups have, quote, quietly walked back their opposition as evidence has mounted that GMOs are both safe to eat and not inherently bad for the environment, end quote. We would disagree. Kahn doesn't mention who these groups might be. She reframes the Philippines story of the destruction of genetically engineered golden rice, yet around that time, even the pro-industry magazine Forbes published an article questioning golden rice's viability and noting that its benefits are only based upon unfounded hypotheses. As for its risks to health, GM Watch in the United Kingdom points out the work conducted by David Shubrick at the Salk Institute, revealing that the rice might potentially generate vitamin A derivatives that could, quote, damage human fetuses and cause birth defects. Kahn, who should be acknowledged, is a highly respected science journalist and teaches journalism at the University of California, Berkeley campus, happens to be a contributing author for the Genetic Literacy Project, GLP, at the University of California, Davis. We believe that this acts more like a public relations operation sponsored by the agrochemical industry. Monsanto, Bayer, Syngenta, and DuPont are among GLP's industry partners. It is one of the most frequently quoted sources for cherry-picked information on pro-GMO advocates and journalists. In our opinion, it is perhaps one of the most financially compromised and scientifically illiterate organizations founded and funded to disseminate pro-GMO propaganda in order to prop up public support for GMOs and genetic engineering in general. In effect, some universities now act as private industry lobbyists. These become a greater scandal when the university is a public institution receiving public funding. This group and its East Coast partner, Cornell University's Alliance for Science, largely funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, serve as the GMO industry's clearinghouses for public relations to spin science into advertising, propaganda, and character assassination of GMO opponents. The Genetic Literacy Project is a key collaborator with another food industry front organization, the American Council on Science and Health. The American Council on Science and Health has, that we can find, nothing to do with actual health science. It has been described by the independent corporate financial watchdog organization, SourceWatch, as a thinly veiled corporate front group that holds, quote, a generally apologetic stance regarding virtually every other health and environmental hazard produced by modern industry, accepting corporate funding from Coca-Cola, Syngenta, Procter & Gamble, Kellogg, General Mills, PepsiCo, and the American Beverage Association, among others. The American Council on Science and Health also favors, toxic pesticides, the use of bisphenol A in products, cigarettes, and hydrofracking. It is closely aligned with pseudo-medical front organizations that criticize alternative and natural health modalities. The GLP group sources a couple thousand corporate-friendly studies favoring GMO benefits and safety. One review of over 1,700 studies, known as the Nicolia Review, for a time was the most cited source, making the broadest claims for GMO safety. However, subsequent independent and unbiased reviews of Nicolai's analysis conclude that many of these studies were tangential at best, barely took notice of anything related to crop genetic engineering. Many studies are completely irrelevant from a value-added perspective because they have nothing to do with GMO safety. Furthermore, other studies in Nicolai's collection conclude the exact opposite of their intention and give further credibility to GMO's environmental, animal, and human health risks. When Nicolia published his review, he omitted and ignored scientifically sound research that directly investigated GMO safety and found convincing evidence to issue warnings. For example, one peer-reviewed publication by over 300 independent scientists declared that there is no scientific consensus that GMO crops and food are safe. Not surprisingly, there is no mention of this study in the Nicolia Review. It is no secret that Monsanto and Big Agriculture have significant influence over the University of California, Davis Agriculture Department and divisions. The bogus economic studies trumpeted by the Big Ag cartel to defeat California's GMO labeling bill, Proposition 37, were performed at University of California, Davis, and then publicized through all of its front groups. Gary Ruskin, who has been filing Freedom of Information Act requests, has publicly expressed deep concerns that University of California, Davis is acting as a financial conduit for private corporations and interests to develop and launch public relations attacks against anyone in academia, such as professors, activists, and other institutions who might oppose those same corporate interests. For GMO opponents, the name Mark Lynas may send shivers down the spine. As soon as any journalist or researcher mentioned Lynas's name approvingly, well, from our perspective and belief, one can certainly then discern the camp the author represents. Therefore, when Kahn quotes Lynas as if he were an unbiased authority on GMOs, we know we have boarded the wrong train and will reach a destination, in our opinion, of distorted scientific facts and self-righteous corporate praise. The public watchdog group, U.S. Right to Know, describes Lynas as, quote, a former journalist turned promotional advocate for genetically engineered foods and pesticides who makes inaccurate claims about those products from his perch at the Gates Foundation-funded Cornell Alliance for Science, end quote. Lynas has accused those who would inform the public about Roundup's carcinogenic properties as conducting a, quote, witch hunt, end quote, by, quote, anti-Monsanto activists, or, quote, abuse science. Lynas has denied his role as a shill for Big Ag. However, a decade ago, The Guardian acquired a private memo from the pro-biotechnology organization EuropoBio about its initiative to recruit, quote, ambassadors, end quote, to preach GMO gospel. Well, who were they talking about? Mark Lynas was specifically named in the document alongside then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan as prime candidates to pressure European agencies who were skeptical about GMO's claims and promises and health and environmental risks. In short, Lynas has been one of Big Agri's most invaluable foot soldiers for over a dozen years. Similar to the Genetic Literacy Project, the Cornell Alliance for Science does not conduct any agriculture research that we're aware of. Yet its tentacles to attack GMO opponents, although those are far-reaching in the media. CAS has launched in 2014, after the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation granted the Alliance $5.6 million in startup monies. The Public Relations Alliance makes the unfounded claim to represent balanced research about genetic and genetically engineered products. One of its missions is to influence the next generation of agricultural researchers to embrace GMO science. For the Genetic Literacy Project, or the Cornell Alliance for Science, well, as for Bill Gates, GMOs are the only food solution for Africa's future. Well, that is easily challenged. 5 years ago, organic New York farmers mobilized to pressure the trustees of Cornell University's faculty to evict this group from the campus and hold its influence over the school's prestigious College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Unfortunately, the alliance is still there. In conclusion, one argument Kahn wants us to buy into is that there were mistakes made during the early rollout of GMOs in the 1990s, but somehow, mysteriously, and without any solid evidence, we are supposed to believe that these same companies now engineering new generations of crops have learned their lessons. All that has really changed has been the genetic technology for altering plant genomes. The same mindset that only technology and the quest for food dominance remain. After hundreds of thousands of dollars were flushed away during a genetically modified wheat project, a retired professor of plant agriculture at the University of Guelph in Canada remarked, quote, we scientists and the public are so malleable, so gullible, or is it because researchers and research administrators are just desperate for money, that we swallow and become promoters of the mantra that GM is somehow going to feed the world by resolving the monumental threat of burnt toast or browning in the cut apples or flower color in carnations? Really? For shame. Let's be honest. The one and only reason these people, corporations, and governments are funding this sorry use of lab bench space is because it may yield a proprietary product, end quote. Following Linus's lead, Kahn wants us to believe that genes exchanged between different plants is common in nature, and therefore, hey, manipulating genes between species with genetic engineering tools such as CRISPR should not worry us. Yes, plants have acquired genes from other organisms in the past, the far distant past. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, however, it is so exceedingly rare that these should be regarded as anomalies without any correlation whatsoever to the millions of different genes available to bioengineer new plant organisms. This has been one of Linus's pet arguments on his bully pulpit since turning his back on his former Greenpeace activists and joining Monsanto's legions. It may also be noted that Jennifer Kahn is an active participant in CRISPR.com, a formal forum dedicated to, quote, the future of CRISPR and gene editing technology applications in agriculture, health, conservation, and more, end quote. Among the organization's supporters are Bayer, the Innovative Genomic Institute, Cornell Alliance for Science, Corteva, AgriScience, and the United Soybean Board. A mission noted on its website is expressed in one of its mottos, quote, the public doesn't trust GMOs, will it trust CRISPR, end quote. This is a public relations pitch that permeates, in our opinion, her Times article. It is important to have only independent investigators and researchers to identify and publicize the background of cloaked public relations shills posing as unbiased journalists in mainstream news stories. We believe Kahn's New York Times piece is an attempt to disingenuously manipulate the narrative so more Americans will love GMOs. In the wake of the agrochemical industry's efforts to bolster favorable images of GMOs, and more recently CRISPR's editing technologies, the mainstream media willingly rolls out a red carpet. No equal publishing space is awarded to the critics of genetic engineering who uncover the flaws in the industry's public relations or their research or their products. Consequently, journalists such as Mark Linus and Jennifer Kahn are the norm rather than exception. Today, the lesson is clear that money, power, and influence sustain much of what we hear about private industry. Take on any cause that is critical of genetic engineering, foods, and big agro will come right after you. Now, I don't know what the ultimate motive is, and they may be completely legitimate and honest as far as this article's author is concerned. But what we do know is that there is a legitimate criticism to everything that the genetically engineered companies and its proponents have argued in the past and put forward. But where is the space? And where is the opportunity to hear their voices? We are many, not a few, and we have a lot of evidence, and much of it obtained under Freedom of Information Act and also from court documents. 7 years ago, 70% of Americans, according to the Consumer Reports National Research Center survey, did not want genetically modified organisms in their food. In 2018, the Pew Research Center reported that only 5% of Americans said GMO foods were better for one's health, which is about what the number of people who are in one way or another invested in the agrochemical industry would represent. Still, over half believe that GMOs endanger health. Yet too much has been invested in agrochemical biotechnology to expect GMOs to disappear or to be looked at or researched honestly and objectively, or to have those individuals like a Dr. Seralini, who did some of the most important work on showing the toxicity of glyphosate, to come forward to have their day before the public in any form. Oh, no. All of the anti-GMO voices, they're silenced. They have no platforms. Anything they say is immediately erased or said to be misinformation. We can also expect to hear even wilder and more irrational claims about how GMOs if they are allowed, will then somehow help us reduce greenhouse gases and save humanity. And we expect much of this PR campaign to be backed by the World Economic Forum's full-throttle Great Reset invasion. In other words, out of desperation to reach global food dominance, the agrochemical industry, backed by Western governments, will be declaring a full food war against the people of the world. Isn't it time for us to unlearn any illusory attachment we may have gotten from big agriculture and to learn to loathe GMOs, or at least learn the truth? I'm Gary Noll. Thank you very much for listening, and have a nice day.